Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakaronga mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
Great to have your company. I'm Janina Schwanaker. Today, we hear about a research project that asked New Zealanders, urban and rural, what they really think about farming.
And a big milk-producing Friesian called Evie has been supreme champion Holstein at the Canterbury Show for 2 years in a row. Cosmo meets the farmer behind the cow.
And Sally, you're off tramping through the forest of Mount Taranaki with mountain ranger Tane Houston.
Yes, it was a beautiful autumn day as well.
But first, our guest this week. You might have heard Cosmo's story last week from the Food, Farming and Freshwater Roadshow in Renwick. The roadshow is moving around rural New Zealand to showcase research to people in the ag sector. Here's another project that was presented at the event.
My name's Janet Reed and I'm a rural researcher from Massey University from the School of Agricultural Environment, and today I was talking about research that I've undertaken with some colleagues from the School of People, Environment and Planning at Massey, funded by our Land and Water, looking at diverse perspectives on farming. That's the title of the research, but what we were interested in is really finding out what people think about the farming sector.
And you interviewed quite a lot of people for this research, didn't you?
We did a survey of over 1,300 people, and then that was a national survey across all genders, age groups. It was representative in terms of covering off, you know, the general population in that sense. And then we followed up with specific interviews to expand on some of the themes that came out of the survey to get a wee bit more detail and depth.
What were some of the key themes that came out of that survey?
We explored what people valued about farming, and very strongly what came through consistently across all of those groups was the value people place for the farming sector on the food that it produces for New Zealanders. Absolutely strongly, highly valued.
Yes, that's a great positive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other key finding, because we were also interested in exploring the so-called urban-rural divide, and what came through in the research, because we asked people to identify whether they would say that they were urban, rural, or urban, rural. And 1 in 5 participants actually identified themselves as urban, rural. So it just reinforces that it's really simplistic to argue, as some people, some media and some politicians can do at times, that there is this big rural-urban divide, because that is not the case. So that was one of the other key findings that came out, was challenging that simplistic idea.
Have you found a sort of farm meets urban connection point?
We would argue that food comes out really strongly as a key connection point for the farming sector to connect to the non-farming sector. And some of the research that we did identified that when we asked people where did they get the majority of their information from, there were a number of sources, but media came out very highly as playing a role in that. But the other interesting thing was that half of urban respondents said that they get the information about farming from the supermarket. So that's the connection point. That's, you know, the food, which, you know, is a huge opportunity for us. We also explored people's trust in the farming sector, and strongly correlated with people's trust was the sense as to whether the sectors were communicating transparently, openly and honestly. And that urban respondents particularly want to feel confidence that the farming sector are doing that. And so the branding, that is absolutely one way. Telling stories in supermarkets, somehow being innovative and creative about how we do that.
And from an ag perspective, this could mean talking more about farm practices and farmers sharing their stories.
Yeah. And I think farmers do that. But I think it's not only farmers that need to do this. We need to think about how the sectors themselves and the industry-funded groups can also get into the space and do things maybe differently to what we're doing. And people also did want that genuine connection. You know, they want to connect with people face-to-face, you know, have some genuine connection with them.
Yes, and food, of course, is, as you've mentioned, potentially the best connector because we all need it, and people are wanting to know more about where their food comes from.
Yes, yeah.
In a positive way.
In a positive way. And who's producing it, how it's being produced, and they want to also be sure that it's being produced in an environmentally responsible way.
Does your research provide any insights into how farmers feel like they are being perceived?
Yes, we explored people's sense of connection between farmers, non-farmers, and consistently there was agreement there was a disconnection. And farmers who responded tended to think that there was a lot of misinformation through the media and other avenues that was influencing how they were being perceived. That was very much from the rural perspective. From the urban perspective, it's similar to what I said before. The urban just wanted greater confidence that, in fact, they were getting honest, clear information about farmers' practices around the environment. Mm.
What can you do with all this valuable data that you've collected? What's the next step?
Good question. I think what it indicates, and for the others in the team, is the need to somehow keep the conversation going and for actually maybe looking at, well, how can we build on what we found? You know, if food is a connection point, how do we develop innovative ways, new ways for actually using that as a way of continuing the conversation, of improving the conversation and those connections between the farming sector?
To ensure everyone's on the same page. What can you action?
Yes. How can we do that?
Have you got any ideas yet?
Personally, I think we need to work more closely with the supermarkets and think about how we can work with them. Of course, they have a strong commercial imperative, but given the results from this research, it would seem to me that we have to think of ways that we can actually, through branding or through some other means, work with the supermarkets to actually build these connections and tell these stories.
That's very doable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sure they might be open to some discussions.
Yeah. Well, particularly if this is what consumers want.
If someone is interested in reading the report, where can they go to find it?
If they access the Our Land and Water website, they will be able to find the research on there, but they can also contact me, Janet Reid at Massey University, and I'd be more than happy to share them a link.
Now for a wrap of the week's rural news with RNZ rural news journalist Monique Steele, who's joining us from Ōtautahi Christchurch. And Monique, disappointing news about the Canterbury A&P show being cancelled. What's happened there?
Yes, well, it's going to be a different Cup and Show Week this year. The annual Christchurch event, which sees country come to town, has been canned as it's not financially viable. Bryce Murray of the Canterbury Agriculture and Pastoral Association, well, he says after 2 years of COVID-19 disrupting the show and a financial loss last year, putting one on this year was just not feasible.
The real problem is your corporate side of the equation with the traffic management, and there's all sorts of other stuff that goes into that, all that equation, wages. Operating on show day being the Friday, and you've got staff there, and so that's always time and a half. Just like, it all adds up.
Livestock judging and competitions will still be held in November as usual, though other parts of the show have been cancelled.
Now, Monique, mixed news for farmers at the meatworks.
Yes, well, venison sales dived during the COVID-19 pandemic, and as you'll remember, that's with the restrictions that closed so many restaurants around the world. But things are on the up, with New Zealand's venison exports to the United States having more than doubled in the year to February. More dairy cull cows flowing into the works have resulted in meat companies lowering their prices too. Meanwhile, sheep meat prices remain at historic lows, with prospects in export markets quite pessimistic. Demand from China has softened, and Australian lambs are still flooding the market. And here, most North Island processors are paying between $6 and $6.30 a kilogram. And in the South Island, sheep are going for $5.80 to just over $6 a kilo.
But it's not all bad news, is it, with some funding to help improve genetics?
Yeah, that's right. So two red meat sector research projects have just got a major funding boost from the New Zealand Meat Board. $1 million is going towards tackling facial eczema. This disease costs the country around $300 million each year through sick or dying animals. And another $700,000 is going to an existing project, which is giving farmers beef genetic tools to increase productivity and profitability. Beef and Lamb Chair Kate Ackland is excited.
There hasn't been a significant investment in the facial eczema space for quite some number of years, actually. So this launching this project and really trying to nail facial eczema is a significant piece of work, and this funding boost from New Zealand Meat Board will help make the project go faster.
The Livestock Improvement Corporation has also celebrated 20 years of being listed on the New Zealand Stock Exchange. In other business news, rural supplies company PGG Wrightson has downgraded its earning guidance as those in the agriculture sector tighten their belts. It's now expecting operating earnings of about $43 million. That's compared to its previous forecasts of $50 million. So you see, reduced spending is biting at agricultural business bottom lines too.
Meanwhile, a rise in alternative meats could change New Zealand farming going forward.
Yes, well, it could. That's if growing demand for alternative proteins could see dairy production decrease by 35% over the next 30 years, a new research has found. The Protein Future Scenarios research project looked at three different possibilities of how alternative meat could impact land use. Its project lead, John Manire, says change is afoot.
We were suggesting that, you know, by 2050, dairy production land use might decrease by 35%, sheep might decrease by 29%, and arable production, because you're looking at a land use shift into arable production, will increase by 21%. And then forestry, because a lot of the hill country, which is currently for sheep and beef, would shift to forestry. So those are quite significant potential changes in land use.
Auckland company called OptoBio, well, it's hoping to ramp up production of its lab-grown meat. It's just started a two-year project to deliver advanced commercial-grade cell lines to enable the cultivation of meat at a larger scale. Co-founder and chief executive Olivia Ogilvie says it's about removing the need for more animals in the food supply chain.
By 2050, meat consumption is predicted to increase by 70%. And the general consensus is that we need new food production techniques to increase our food production by that quantum in cultivated meat. And this technology is one of those options.
Now, staying with technology, a new smart app is helping orchardists better manage trees individually.
Yes, well, FruitMinder is a new type of software, and it gives growers specific data about their trees, like growing conditions, treatments, sprays and fertilisers. It works kind of like smart ear tags used on cattle and helps create GPS-mapped digital twins of the orchard. Founder and CEO Sebastian Chapman says he's still fine-tuning the tech, but it will be available on the market soon.
They've got the aid of a map on the application, so they can use that to easily find the trees that they want to do their census with. And then we also do all the sort of the maths on getting the averages and whatnot out for them. So made it really simple.
Now, an international forestry auditor has spoken out about what they've witnessed on the East Coast in terms of trees.
Yes, well, public concern about the extent of damage caused by forestry slash on the East Coast during these big storms in recent years, including cyclones Hale and Gabrielle, well, they prompted a visit from auditors called Assurance Services International, or ASI, last year. It reviewed audits done by SGS and Preferred by Nature, which found a severe level of inadequate standards being carried out here. The auditor says issues with the New Zealand companies were at the most serious end of offending. And because of the scale of the issues on the East Coast, ASI will come back later this year to check out other forest auditors around New Zealand. Meanwhile, as a result of the auditor's visit late last year, forestry company Earnslaw One lost its internationally recognised FSC certification, and that indicates that the trees were harvested responsibly.
OK, Monique, what's happening in the world of milk and honey?
Well, Fonterra is closing a handful of its plants in Waikato to optimise operations, it says. The dairy co-op will close its powder plant and coal centre at Waitoa later this year, and two drying plants at Te Rapa, which will close by next month. Around 50 roles will be impacted by the closure, some of which are vacant. But for those staff that are impacted, Fonterra says it will try to redeploy them across the co-op in the first instance. So that's one to watch there. And that's us from the Rural News team this week.
Thanks, Monique.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
North Kent refarmer Olivia Cahill loves Holstein Friesian cows. It's a family passion that goes back generations. She runs the award-winning Shireen Holstein Stud on the family dairy farm in Ōhuka near Christchurch. Cosmo Kentish Barnes popped in and asked her where she's from.
I originated from down south Canterbury in a place called Milford near Clandeboy, and we moved to North Canterbury when I was about seven. Always on a dairy farm, so it's my parents' farm, and I'm born and bred dairy farmer.
And tell me about the farm here.
We're on 152 hectares. We milk big Holsteins, use mainly North American genetics, and they're all pedigree cows with large milk, and yeah.
What was it like as a child being brought up on this farm?
It was amazing. Out there working when we were young, but just the love of being outside, being with the animals. I think it's just such a great upbringing for kids.
Yes.
And my kids are out there doing it as well, enjoying it.
How old are your kids?
I've got Tom, who is 8, and Isabel, who's 5. And Tom's out there on the motorbike. He goes and gets the cows up and does lots of jobs for me. And Isabel just spends her time with the calves and the sheds.
So you must have learnt heaps about farming from your folks.
Yes, that's right. Yep. So Dad and I work together on the farm. I do all the morning milkings, he does all the evenings, and then we're both on the farm throughout the whole day.
Yes, and your husband, Jared, is a firefighter?
Yes, he works in Christchurch as a career firefighter. So he does his shifts of 2 days, 2 nights, and then he has 4 days off, which are spent on the farm with me. Confidence with a microphone is not really my thing. I'm saying that talking into a microphone.
It's all good. We are heading down to the farmyard now because in the shed there are some newborn calves.
Yep, so we split calves, so we're calving in 90 cows this autumn, 45 have already calved, so I've got a few calves running around. I had one calf this morning, which is out in the paddock still, so we'll get her in this afternoon and milk the cow and feed the calf.
Quite good conditions for calving at the moment.
Yes, it's very dry. Not good conditions to grow grass though. We're still irrigating and it's, what is it, beginning of April.
Are you having to do supplementary feeding?
Yep, so we feed grass baleage at the moment. Our maize has just come in off the paddock, so we'll be into that in a couple of weeks.
Yes. And have you got a good store of baleage for the winter?
Yes, yep. Yeah, a lot of bales. We've got well over 800 or 900 bales for the winter, and we had 17 hectares of maize.
Now we've come up to the dairy shed and you've got your milk vat here. Is that full for the day?
Yes, it is. The tank is coming today to pick it up. So, yep, it's full of milk.
How much milk do you produce?
It's about 8,000 litres every second day at the moment pick up. So the cows are milking really well. We're only milking 180 cows. So for this time of year, they're doing really well.
Does someone have to be here when the Fonterra truck turns up?
No.
So they
just come in and take the milk and rinse the vat.
Now behind the milk shed you've got another shed where the calves are?
Yes, So this is our young calves in here, and they're ranging from a day to about a week old.
And you've got, what, 7 or 8 here?
Yep, and then they'll move over to the automatic calf feeder.
They're looking pretty happy and healthy, aren't they?
They are indeed. The Holstein Friesians. As I said, North American genetics. So there's some pretty exciting young calves in here.
As a breeder, what are you looking for?
Nice framey calves with nice bone. The colours don't really matter.
The colours don't matter?
No, as long as they're black and white, which they are.
Just sneak in here. Now there are some more calves in this shed where the feeder is, and in fact there's one having some tucker right now. So the calves all have tags in their ears, and this automatic feeder can read the tag. How does it know how much food to give to a calf?
So every calf gets 3.6 litres twice a day. So as that 12 hours kicks over, the calf comes in and it will feed it again.
So if a calf has already had its allocated amount of food and tries to get more,
the machine won't let it. No, that's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Quite an investment.
It is. It's great though. It's a labour unit that we don't need, and I only need to check the feeder once a day as opposed to feeding them twice a day. So it's great.
It looks like the milk has stopped flowing, but the calf's still trying to get more out of the teat.
Yep, so she'll give up soon and back out, and another one will wander in for a drink.
Yes.
And we leave them on for about 90 days until the calves are about 100 kgs. So the calf feeder will automatically wean them at a certain amount of days.
Yeah. So how long will it be before they go into the milking shed?
So they calve in at about 2 years old, and then we'll milk them.
And they're good milk producers?
Very good milk producers, yep. We're probably averaging around the 650 kgs per cow. That's milk solids. Cows are doing about 10,000 litres in a lactation, which is 305 days.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yes.
So how many litres is that a day?
We've got cows doing 40 litres. Our average is about 28 to 30 litres at the moment.
Yeah.
But that's forever changing depending on the time of year and how many fresh calves we've got in and how many stale cows we're milking.
What's the highest milk producer you've ever had in terms of litres per day?
Ooh, we've had cows doing over 60 litres per day.
We've come outside now, and around us are your paddocks, and there are quite a few trees that the cows can shade under.
Yes, that's right. It's quite an old farm that we're on here with some big, beautiful old trees, and we love that for shelter in adverse weather and for shade in the summer as well.
Excellent. Well, we are going to hop on your quad bike and head out onto the farm. Now we can see a cow that's just given birth.
Yep, I think she gave birth while I was milking the cows this morning, because there wasn't a calf out there when I checked them before I started, so yep. So this is our feed pad.
Do you use this feed pad when it's just too wet for the cows to go on the paddocks?
We use it when we feed out anything, baleage and maize. So we don't feed anything out on the paddocks. And in the winter when it's wet, you feed out on the concrete feed pad to stop any pugging and also controlling the effluent.
What's your biggest expense on the farm?
That's a good question. Fertiliser's definitely a big expense, and buying our wheat in is another big expense.
Are you looking at ways to try and reduce your fertiliser use to save costs?
Yes, definitely. So we spread all our own effluent out on the farm. We are lucky where we are that our grass grows really well and we don't actually use a lot of fertiliser anyway.
Yeah.
And well under the nitrogen cap that the council and government have put on.
Sound effects. Now we are coming up to your herd of milking cows.
Yes, we are. Yep, there's 180 cows out there.
We are surrounded by large Holstein dairy cows.
Yep, they're all pretty happy right now, sitting down chewing or eating their cud.
Now, some of these cows are part of your Charaine Holstein stud.
That's right, yep, that's about 100 years of breeding. My great-granddad started breeding Holsteins back in 1923. Yep.
And each generation has kept that passion alive.
They have, yep. So my granddad took two of my great-granddad's cows and started his own herd called Deloraine. And then 30 years ago, my dad left Deloraine and moved up to North Canterbury with about 80 of the cows. They split the herd in half, I believe. And yeah, we moved up here and created Charaine.
And we are standing in front of Evie.
Yes.
Who is your champion cow.
That's right, yep.
Supreme champion.
Supreme Holstein champion at Christchurch or Canterbury Show for 2 years in a row now.
2 years in a row. Yeah. Unlike some of the other cows, she's very slow to get up because I guess she knows you so well.
Yes, yep. She's she's very calm and friendly and used to having people around her.
Yeah, she's a big girl. What is so special about her? What makes her such a top cow?
She's just a great dairy cow. She's got everything you want in a cow. She's a great bone. She milks well. She's calved every year. She's had 5 calves. She's only 6 years old. She produces a lot of milk. So at the moment, she's still doing 40 litres. She's been milking for about 200 days. Yeah.
So what do you do to prepare her for a big show?
For the Canterbury show, we generally cut our team out about 5 or 6 weeks before the show and get them into a routine of eating hay and, a bit of pasture and get them on a show mix meal so they get some speedy beet, which is what you'd feed a horse and stuff like that. So just getting them used to it, getting them tied up, breaking them in if they've never been on a halter before and just getting them in a routine. And yeah, I do most of the show work now, but it's been in my family forever. Dad used to do it, and
yeah. Do you have to stay on site to look after your cows 24/7?
Yes. Yep. So we generally will go into the showgrounds about 5 days before the show, get the cows settled in. There will be someone on shift the whole time watching the cows and, keeping them clean and happy and fed.
What sort of price can you get for one of these cows?
Whew, it depends. We sold a calf last year that went for $7,000. I think the top price for a yearling was $13,000 at the sale. And north of $20,000 for a good cow.
Olivia Carhill there, talking to Cosmo on her farm in North Canterbury. By the way, we should let you know about the award we won last week. Country Life won Best Weekly Factual Feature at the New Zealand Radio and Podcast Awards for the third year running. Thanks to all those in the production team.
Well, hi, I'm Eric Linklater. I'm one of the sale yards guys in Fielding, and we take people around the sale yards, and you'd be most welcome to come and join us, and you're now listening to Country Life.
Imagine your office is the side of a mountain and one is revered as the great volcanic peak at the heart of the Taranaki region. Well, it is just that for mountain ranger Tane Houston, who you might bump into on one of the tracks, checking traps or passing on his knowledge to visiting school kids. He's part of the Taranaki Maunga project, which aims to bring the Maunga and the people who live around it back to health. He always starts with a karakia.
Tēnā koe, te maunga, tēnā koe, tēnei ngāhere, te wao nui o Tāne. Nei rā, te mihi ki tō o Irua, Tawhito. Tēnei mātau, tēnei au, te reo. My name is Tane Houston. Tane Wurumu Houston. I'm really honoured to be a mountain ranger here on Maunga Taranaki. So I'm based out of the south of Taranaki, living in Hawera. But I'm a part of an organisation that looks after the entire Maunga. I engage with the mountain as a living being and I'm a part of an organisation, a whānau, that's encouraging the world to see the mountain in the same light.
Tane is tall and burly. He strides ahead of me up a slowly rising track. He wears tramper's leggings, well-worn boots and a high-vis vest. His pockets are bulging with all the things you might need for trapping and keeping safe in the bush. I'm curious about his name, the same as Tane, god of the forest.
So at my time of birth, my grandmother christened me Tane Mahuta. But my mother thought that that name was a little bit too significant and probably too heavy a name to carry through the world, so I took the name of my grandfather, which is Tane Houston. But my grandmother reminds me now of her foresight, I suppose, and that now working in the space in the ngahere and working deep within the forest of Tane Mahuta, my grandmother's quick to remind me that when I was born, she named me Tane Mahuta, yeah. But nah, I'm nothing like Tane Mahuta. We're just humble people that get to work in this beautiful space, but I suppose I'll just share that funny story on behalf of my grandmother.
It's all right.
Others are coming up the track behind us, and we move aside to let them pass. They're volcanologists. This is their office too.
Be safe. See you later. Yes.
Mount Taranaki is considered to be a sleeping, active volcano. The last major eruption was around the mid-1600s. It stands just over 2,500 metres high, one of the most symmetrical volcanic cones in the world. Like an island, the sea in which it sits, rich, fertile farmland. And that's what makes it somewhat easier to get rid of predators and pests and fulfil the project's mission of restoring the landscape.
Taranaki Maunga Project is one organisation that exists in a massive community of a whole heap of organisations that are doing their best to fulfil this purpose of restoring the well-being of our mountain, restoring the well-being of the forest, restoring the well-being of the waterways, restoring the well-being of all of the native wildlife, and restoring the well-being of the community's connection to the mountain and to the natural environment. That's who I work for. That is the mission that I'm a part of. So what that looks like from day-to-day operations all the way through to the wider purpose or the bigger picture, it starts often next to a Dock 200. So we've arrived here next to a trap here on the mountain. We have thousands of traps on the mountain and a lot of different types of traps. But today we're working with the Dock 200. It's about the size of a letterbox, and they're placed in 100-metre increments along every track that we have here on the mountain. This trap in particular targets rats and mustelids. So the mustelids are stoats, weasels and ferrets. I'm going to open this trap up here. So these traps on our public track, they're screwed tight just to ensure that the public don't try and have a tutu with the trap and end up getting caught inside of it. And as we can see, I promise I haven't staged this, but we've got a young Norwegian rat that's here caught in our Dock 200, quite a fresh kill. And this is quite a common sight for us here on the mountain, so every 3 weeks when we are baiting these Dock 200s, we definitely find rats and stoats often in all of our traps.
It's kind of satisfying, isn't it? But then it's also...
They're still out there. Yep, they're still out there. So, yeah, it's a win when we are catching rats But it's also, you're absolutely right, it's also a reminder that these pests and predators do exist out here. So when we catch heaps of stoats or heaps of rats, we celebrate having caught heaps of rats or heaps of stoats, but on that same note, we're definitely reminded that these threats to kiwis, these threats to whio, these threats to totowai still exist here on the mountain. So it just shows us we've got a lot of work to do. So these first 30 odd traps along this public track we have made available for the South Taranaki hiking group, a small group of really dedicated trappers. We allow them these traps here to engage with. And they sort of customise their traps in a pretty cool fashion. You can see here they've attached a bit of a wire brace to the top of the box that can hold a prune. And so they've decided for the moment that they'll use a prune as bait, which looks like it might have done a good job.
Ooh,
there's also a fake egg in there.
Oh, yes.
And they've used some walnut in there as well. So they're...
lots of tasty tidbits there.
Yeah, they've been really creative with the baits that they're using in this 200, and it's obviously worked. And I've just now set the trap again, seeing that this bait here, this prune and this walnut are still quite fresh. There's no need to re-bait, but I am carrying fresh rabbit on me for any of the traps that need to be re-baited with anything more fresh. But this is good to go as it is. I'm going to close this back up. What we're going to do is we're going to just chuck this rat in the bush and let the insects have it.
Goodbye, rat.
We lock this box up, keep it safe, keep the public safe. And that is how we engage with the Doc 200. There are thousands of Doc 200s right across the mountain. And so every 3 weeks, there are massive amounts of our community that are out here in the voluntary capacity and in the staff capacity alongside Department of Conservation tending to these traps and doing our best to get rid of the rats, get rid of the stoats, get rid of the threat.
We talked about rats. I understand that goats have been eliminated. What would it have been like before when the goats were here?
Well, I suppose for the listeners, if I just describe this bush that we're in at the moment, you almost, to your left and right hand side of the track, can't see your feet. So what that means is that without goats here on the track, the undergrowth is thriving. So as far as we can look left, as far as we can look right, there is undergrowth everywhere, 10 centimetres, 30 centimetres, metre high undergrowth just surrounding the base of all of these larger trees. Years ago, when the goat was here, a lot of this low-lying undergrowth would not have existed, and you'd just see bare ground and exposed root. But here, we're not seeing any exposed root, nor are we seeing any bare ground. The whole ground is just covered with beautiful native rako, native tree life.
Very lush, isn't it?
It's very lush, yeah. Super green, heaps of beautiful colours, loving the colour of the horopito there. The pepper plant has a lush red leaf, and it's reaching up alongside these beautiful raudeko and kamahi trees that are covered in a really lush moss as well. So,
what a huge result to get rid of the goats.
It's massive. Yeah, it has been absolutely mind-blowing to not have any browsers here on the mountain. I've had many discussions with rangers and with conservationists all over the country, and they are still in a position where the deers and the pigs and the goats are browsing through their forests, and so they exist in forests where the roots of the larger trees are exposed. Here on Taranaki, you will absolutely get lost in the bush if you step out off track, and that's just due to this massive amount of undergrowth that exists. So it's beautiful, it's absolutely luscious, and it really does give you a glimpse of how wonderful New Zealand native forest can be if we look after it really well.
We know that the Maunga is kind of like an island, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's, dare I say it, a little bit easier to do the kind of work that you're doing?
Yeah, it sure is, yeah.
What are the lessons learned for other projects around the country?
The project itself sort of saw the mountain as an island. We know that we have heaps of success trapping offshore islands, and we wanted to transfer that success to the mainland, and it was decided that Taranaki Maunga project, or Taranaki Maunga, would be a great place to do that. How that benefits other projects is that we can have a concentration of all of the different tools and newly developed tools on the Maunga. We can test them, we can trial them, we can run experiments here on the mountain regarding different ways of getting rid of pests and predators. Once we find that any of those systems work well, we can then advocate for those systems to be introduced to other projects across the country.
Despite not being an island like here?
Yeah, it can do for sure, especially the satellite systems. So the traps that are connected to Bluetooth and satellite systems, those traps coming out of Zip technology, so they're an organisation in Wellington and working in Christchurch, they work across the country. Their system is here on the mountain, and as that system develops, regardless of bush out there that isn't like an island, those systems will be of huge benefit to other parts of Aotearoa that are looking to control pest and predator numbers for sure.
The Maunga project has been going 9 years and it covers 34,000 hectares. It also includes the Puakai and Kaitaki ranges to the northwest of the mountain and the Ngamotu Sugarloaf Islands.
So for us, over those 9 years of working with the community to bring the ecology, to bring Papatuanuku and Tāne Mahuta back to life, we've now arrived at a position where we can bring kiwi back. And so the amount of trapping that's taking place on the mountain, the amount of community engagement working with organisations such as Taranaki Kiwi Trust and Rotokare Scenic Reserve, as well as Te Ara Taiao and Department of Conservation. There's so many groups that we work with. And because we're working with such an awesome amount of community groups, we've really got a handle on the amount of pests and predators that are here on the mountain. And because of that, we're in a position now to engage in massive amounts of kiwi being returned to the mountain.
But there have been some losses, haven't there?
There have been some losses, yes. So naturally we're going to lose kiwi every now and then. There are still pests on the mountain. There are still predators on the mountain. Last year, out of about 60 kiwi moved to the mountain, we lost four, three to predator and one to misadventure. So naturally we are going to lose birds, but we aim to keep that number as low as possible. Another thing is that through those losses, we've been able to really learn where the holes in our systems are so that we can absolutely focus on...
And where are they, where those holes?
Those holes exist down on the boundary, and so it's all about reinvasion. We have, the mountain is covered in traps, and so now we're working really closely with TRC and our local farming community to ensure that the trapping that's happening on the farm is awesome as well. And we've been doing some really good work this year to support the trapping that's happening on the farms, and that's a way that we've been sure to try and cover that gap, which is reinvasion to the mountain. And we're doing really well, and the community's working together really well to do it.
And apart from the traps, you also have other tools, don't you? Cameras, for instance.
Yes, cameras. We also have satellite equipment that's attached to our traps, so we have traps that communicate to our phones and tell us exactly what's going on the mountain. Cameras will highlight any density of predator, so if our cameras are picking up ferrets in any location consistently, we know that that location needs a lot more work, and so we just get straight in there and be sure that that area is taken care of.
An increasing number of feral cats are being caught. Tane says about two or three a week. How big are these cats?
Oh, they're like little bears. They're interesting, feral cats. Cats that have maybe a few generations. Cats that have like second and third generation in the bush, they do grow like different features. They've got a thicker fur. It seems like they have like shorter, stubbier, stronger legs, shorter, stubbier, stronger necks. They look like little bears. They look like little cubs. They look quite rough, but they look quite menacing. They don't look like your fluffy cat that you have at home, that's for sure. They still look kind of clumsy when they're in the bush, but if we give it another 5 years, maybe a decade, we might have a real issue when I think these cats are going to turn into real predators in the bush if we don't watch out.
And if you do find a cat in a trap, what do you do with it?
So most of the traps that we have for cats are traps that will kill the cat instantly. But if we are targeting specific areas where we know that there has been sign of cat either caught on camera or seen by farmers, we'll go in with a live cage capture and we'll capture that cat live, especially if it's in proximity to farms, just to be sure that it's not somebody's pet. And so we'll capture it live and we'll see if it has a chip or any electronic data embedded in the cat to tell us that it is somebody's pet. If it's somebody's pet, we'll obviously return it safely to the home of the owner. But if we are sure that it's nobody's pet, we'll dispose of that cat quickly. I'm always on the lookout for different things to eat.
You eat from the bush?
Yeah, well, as part of our learnings and being lucky to share the space with the experts of rongoā and of sort of native forest, we get exposed to different types of this vegetation that we can eat. This is a kawawau plant, so it's just a little plant that grows off of the trunks of other trees, and when it's transparent, so at the moment you can see that this is a non-transparent leaf. That's a real dark green leaf. I don't know, sort of the shape of a maple leaf in a funny way, elongated maple leaf. But when that leaf is transparent, it's quite a luscious little bite.
What does it taste like?
Tastes like walnut. I found a little transparent one here. Like a little salad green.
It's so
it's
like
a
walnut.
It's got a nutty flavour.
Mm.
It's only a little one, but
It's actually quite nice.
Sometimes we come out here and spend time in the huts, especially if we're working deep in the forest. We have to be out here for a few nights, and when you're out here for a few nights, you're usually eating sort of dehydrated foods, foods that we have to reconstitute. But after a little while, you need that fresh bite, and so it's really cool to come into the forest and know exactly what is edible and have a fresh bite.
Fresh this, salad from the bush.
This horopito plant here, I'm not sure what the English name for it is, but we can call it pepper plant because this plant here is a hot pepper.
You're not going to fool me with that.
Yeah. but it is lovely. It's
a spicy. It numbs your lips sometimes, doesn't it?
It's a spicy nibble. But dried up. We've taken some and dried it up and put it on our steaks, and it is nice. That one was real spicy.
The mountain ranges are covering on average 14 kilometres a day and come across visitors from all over the world.
Hello.
Hey, good morning there.
Hi. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you.
How far are you going today?
Try to get to Sarnhat. Cool. Depends on the weather.
It's not a good day for the weather, so we will try our best. Yeah. I'm from the north of Spain. Also, there are mountains in there, so we'll see.
Your mountains are different from ours, I guess.
They're very different. The forest is wonderful. So we'll see what we can see there.
And the birds, are you listening?
Yeah. And the bees. We are far away from the city. That's the most important part.
True, the peace. Well, the you peace. Have a lovely day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. How long have you been doing this job?
So this is my fourth year working with the Maunga. And
what,
it has been life-changing.
Life-changing?
Yeah, hard out. Yeah, the well-being that is provided on the mountain is unmeasurable. I don't know what it is exactly, but I know that since having the opportunity to spend sort of many days a week out here on the mountain, maybe reprioritise how I look at life. I'm not sure if even that's it. I can't describe it. But I know that my life is far better now than it ever has been. And I know that one of the major influences on that that well-being is being here, high levels of oxygen, good physical activity, and just no noise, no pollution, birds, tree life, drinking from the rivers.
What were you doing before?
Before I was working in the social arena, so a lot of work with high schools, a lot of work around youth development, particularly in and around the marae. And so just working to support young Māori males from the marae and helping the younger generations grow into whatever it is they want to grow into, and just giving them tools. And
you would still do that sort of work on the maunga, wouldn't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Taranaki Maunga Project, it's all about connecting community to the maunga. And so we do that in many different ways, but one of the ways that we really enjoy doing that is by bringing schools in and working with youth groups and working with Te Ara Taiao, who coordinate our local schools into the natural environment. So we bring kids in and we just expose them to the space. We don't really do much talking. We let the forest talk for itself. We just take them on some beautiful walks. Sometimes we expose them to the science that we engage in, and they can be in whatever mood before we get into the bush. By the time we get out of the bush, they're laughing. You can see that their energy is high. They're all smiling. They absolutely love the mountain, and I haven't had an engagement with rangatahi on the mountain where they haven't come out feeling good.
And do they want to come back?
They love it. They want to come back. They want to be rangers. They want to be kaitiaki. They want to be conservationists. They want to know more about professional pathways in terms of science and all things to do with volcanology and all things to do with native species and tree and river. They love it and they want it.
I suppose many of them would have lived with this maunga in their short lives, yep, and not really connected with it, or just had it there and taken it for granted.
Yeah. So, and much is the case right across the board, not just with our young ones, but even our kaumātua, even our elders, and many of our community who have lived in Taranaki, and everybody sees the mountain in the morning when we wake up. You don't have to go far without seeing the mountain. It's been interesting to find out that people have never really had the experience of coming far into the bush and seeing what the mountain has to offer on the inside.
Mountain ranger Dane Houston heading off up the track on Mount Taranaki. And after I visited, 34 kiwi were released into Te Papakura o Taranaki, the former Egmont National Park. About 110 kiwi are expected to be released there this year. Well, that's about it for this week. Thanks for joining us.
See you next time.
Ka kite anō.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.